Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Comic Book Women, Characters, Creators, and Culture in the Golden Age by Peyton Brunet and Blair Davis. Foreword by Trina Robbins. Narrated by C.S.E. Cooney. Foreword. Trina Robbins. I was lucky enough to have a schoolteacher mother who not only taught me to read at the age of four, but who supplied me with books and comics to read, and I did, avidly. But the comics, while beautifully drawn and absolutely charming, were the kind mothers approved of. Funny animals, Raggedy Ann and Andy, cute kids comics like Our Gang. The candy store that sold comics was two blocks away, which meant I had grown big enough to cross two streets before I could choose and buy comics on my own. When I did, for the first time, I was faced with a dizzying array of choices. Superheroes, teen humor, mystery and adventure, cowboys. What to choose? The decision was automatic and easy. I chose any comic with a girl or woman on the cover, but not the pretty girls tied to a chair so the hero could rescue them. I went for the women who had their own comic, with their own name on the cover, women who could take care of themselves. And there were plenty. Of course, Wonder Woman, but also Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, with her flowing golden hair and her leopard skin dress. And Mary Marvel, a preteen girl who said the magic word Shazam to become a girl who could fly and punch out the bad guys. I played with the idea that maybe if I could find my magic word, my Shazam, I too could gain superpowers. And there were the teenagers, Patsy Walker, Millie the model, Katie Keene, who you could even design clothes for if you were brave enough to mail them to Katie's creator, Bill Wagon. I was never brave enough, but I enjoyed the sometimes bizarre designs other kids sent in, and I quietly drew my own paper dolls and fashions at home. Never mind if there was only a Patsy Walker comic once a month, or a jumbo comic starring Sheena every 2 months. I never ran out of girls' comics. If I finished Sheena, there was still Fight Comics starring Tiger Girl. And if I finished Millie the Model, there was Hedy Devine, the movie star. If I was faced with waiting a month for the next Wonder Woman, there were the four superheroines from Timely, later Atlas and later Marvel Comics, Sun Girl, Namora, Venus, the goddess herself come down to Earth, and Blonde Phantom, fighting crime in a slinky red evening gown. I never read the superheroes. They were boring, and I couldn't relate to them. I only wanted to lose myself in page after brightly colored page of adventures of girls and women. They were somehow more human than the men. Many didn't have superpowers at all. Wonder Woman didn't fly in those days. She simply was able to run incredibly fast and leap incredibly high because of her Amazon training. The idea of her creator, William Moulton Marston, was to show that ordinary girls, with the right training, could be almost as powerful as the Amazon princess. Others had powers that were attainable if you found the right magic word, like Mary Marvel, or pressed the right nerve, like Scarlett O'Neill, who pressed a nerve on her left wrist to become invisible. Teen heroines like Patsy Walker and Katie Keene had no powers except their smarts and optimistic resilience. About a year ago, I discovered the answer to a question. Do women and men react differently to comics? I was being interviewed by a filmmaker for a documentary on the late underground cartoonist Spain Rodriguez. When I told her I'd loved Sheena comics as a kid, she told me that Spain and cartoonist Victor Moscoso, both around the same age as me, had also loved Sheena. Both Spain and Moscoso, she said, told her they used to draw Sheena naked. Did I, she asked, also draw Sheena naked? I was outraged. How dare they? I sputtered. Of course I didn't draw Sheena naked. I wanted to be her. Introduction. Comic Studies has chronicled the history of the medium in ways that are centered almost exclusively on men. Two of the most influential and widely cited histories of comics are Men of Tomorrow by Gerard Jones and Of Comics and Men by Jean-Paul Gabillier. Both are exceptional works, but women play a very small role in both. The male-dominated focus of comics historians is also seen in the titles of books such as David Kunzel's Father of the Comic Strip, Jan Bernard Stoltz's The Men Who Made the Comics, Bob Batchelor's Stan Lee, The Man Behind Marvel, and Matthew J. Putz's Comic Book Culture, Fanboys and True Believers, as well as the cover blurb for Joe Simon and Jim Simon's The Comic Book Makers. The young men in the golden age of comics were as bizarre as the characters they created. Comics history regularly describes the medium as one built by men who told tales about male heroes. But what would a female-centric history of comics, one that placed women at the center of comics history instead of on the sidelines, look like? Our understanding of genres like the Western, crime, horror, superhero, and sci-fi comics would shift dramatically, and the narratives surrounding how auteurs such as Stan Lee and Will Eisner built their careers would also be altered. The story of how comic books were born and how they evolved changes significantly when we place women up front rather than at the margins of this history. In their introduction to a special issue of Inks, the Journal of the Comics Studies Society, in 2019 on underground comics, Margaret Galvin and Leah Meismer urge the application of feminist praxis to how we tell the history of comics in comic studies. They argue, a practice of feminist historiography involves looking at things differently and questioning the accepted methods that reproduce the same narratives which exclude by building a lineage through dominant forces, through straight, white, cis men, rather than through another route. In turn, a feminist history of comics should include the reclaiming of women's efforts as writers, artists, editors, and other roles within the industry in its early decades, as well as the recentering of the female characters who were often much more pivotal to the evolution and success of various genres than given credit for. Both on the page and in publishers' studios, women fought for legitimacy throughout the early history of comic books. Many strong heroines arose, certainly, such as Wonder Woman, the Black Cat, Phantom Lady, Miss Fury, and Señorita Rio. But there were far more damsels in distress, conniving temptresses, boy-crazed teeny boppers, haggard crones, nosy old biddies, bossy battle axes, and other overworked clichés. In the humor series Dizzy Dames, for example, the tagline read, "Screwballs in Skirts." And the first issue's cover featured a young woman asking, "You mean this isn't where they pick Miss America?" to the shocked judges at a dog show. When any particular group of people sees itself portrayed in hurtful, hateful, thoughtless, boorish, ignorant, awkward, or indifferent terms, the consequences for how that group sees itself, along with how others see them from the outside, can be lasting. As fictional stories regularly depict one's culture, race, or gender in disparaging or inaccurate ways, it becomes difficult to counteract the steady drumbeat of those stereotypes. If these patterns are repeated often enough over time, negative attitudes and opinions can become solidified across generations. The ways in which women have been represented in comics are one such instance of how media images can have lasting consequences. What most comics fans refer to as the Golden Age of comics, spanning much of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, has been a forum for frequently problematic, often uncomfortable, at times complex, and occasionally inspiring depictions of women. While the comics industry saw women such as Lily Renee, Toni Bloom, and Marcia Snyder working across a range of different genres in this era, most female characters were created, written, and drawn by men, a pattern that has only recently begun to see any significant degree of change. For every appearance of a strong heroine or powerful villain like Miss Fury or Madame Satan, there were even more blatantly sexist moments, such as the time Batman threatened Catwoman with the phrase, "Quiet or Papa Spank," during her first appearance in Batman No. 1, 1940. Comic book publishing is still a predominantly male industry even today, despite the inroads made by female writers, artists, editors, and executives. The 1960s, 70s, and 80s saw pioneering comic book creators such as Marie Severin, Trina Robbins, Louise Simonson, and Ann Nocenti working for both DC and Marvel Comics on such top characters as Spider-Man, Wonder Woman, The Hulk, and Daredevil. But their work was regularly overshadowed by their male counterparts. Now, decades later, there are more women working in comics than at any point in history, but the symptoms of past neglect still linger. It wasn't until 2018 that a female creator first won an Eisner Award, the comics industry's top honor since its 1988 debut, for Best Writer. Marjorie Liu won for Monstress, but she shared the award with Tom King for his work on Mr. Miracle and various Batman titles, the first tie in that category's history. Consider this moment a bit further. A woman wins an Eisner for Best Writer for a series about a powerful female hero for the first time in the three decades of the award's history, but she has to share it with a male writer who writes about male characters. Liu's win is a key moment in the history of female comics creators, but it comes with a glaring footnote. Few women earned public recognition for their work making comic books in the initial decades of the medium. For every woman like June Tarpe Mills, whose name appeared within the pages of their creations, albeit under the pen name Tarpe Mills to disguise her gender, far more labored in uncredited roles as editors, letterers, and colorists. Some were even ghost artists and ghost writers for their male counterparts, while others took over as lead artists during World War II when numerous comics creators were drafted. Comics scholar and Image Comics editor Jennifer M. Smith notes, "It's important to realize that there have always been women as characters in comics, as readers of comics, and as creators of comics. And I don't just mean of independent comics or romance comics. Comics, as a medium, has always had tons of women in various areas. But even within the narrow domain of superhero comics, it's important not to erase the contribution of the women who have been there since the Golden Age, as artists, as writers, as editors. Women as editors have been really integral to comics production for decades. It's important for us to acknowledge that history." The comics industry continues to be regarded as a male-dominated space where women, whether characters, creators, or readers, are at best routinely tokenized and at worst perpetually marginalized. In more recent years, the presence of female creators producing work for and about complex and compelling women, girls, and non-binary people has certainly increased, but the public face of feminism in comics remains lacking. If the endless array of t-shirts, tote bags, and blockbuster films featuring spandex-clad superheroines are to be believed, the only powerful women in comics are those with superpowers. This super-feminism risks neglecting not only that characters from other genres can be equally empowering, but also that there are women on the creative side who have crafted countless stories dating back more than 80 years about women who don't have super strength or immortality. Unless we acknowledge that women have had a longer and richer history as comics characters and creators than most people realize, the current moment in which cinematic superheroines such as Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel have captured the public's attention, risks being little more than a patronizing pat on the head seeking to reassure us, see, girls can be strong too. The current state of women in comics stems, in no small part, from the early history of comic books, which is typically chronicled from the perspective of male creators such as Will Eisner, Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster, Bob Kane, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Joe Simon, Jack Cole, and Joe Kubert. Comic books, we are told, were built primarily by these men of tomorrow, as a male-driven endeavor that succeeded via such characters as Superman, Batman, the Human Torch, Captain America, Captain Marvel, Archie Andrews, Blackhawk, Plastic Man, and other male heroes. But this grand narrative of comics history has excluded the vital contributions made by creators such as Ruth Atkinson, Tony Bloom, Barbara Hall, Fran Hopper, June Tarpe Mills, Lily Renee, and Ruth Roche to the industry's development. Maurice Horne's The World Encyclopedia of Comics does not contain entries for any of these women, for instance. Equally neglected are the pivotal roles played by such characters as Sally the Sleuth, Olga Mesmer, Fantoma, the Magician from Mars, Sandra of the Secret Service, the Black Cat, Moon Girl, Sheriff Sal, Gail Allen, Sally O'Neill, and Two-Gun Lil to the development of numerous genres. As feminist scholar Bell Hooks writes, "Feminist critiques of all male canons of scholarship or literary work expose biases based on gender, a process that is central to making a place for the recovery of women's work and contemporary place for the production of new work by and about women. In turn, a feminist history of comics must reclaim the forgotten work done by women in the industry, along with examining both the cultural and industrial consequences of how women were represented across various genres. Our intention is not merely to point out instances of misogyny or to chart the oppression of women in every corner of the comics world. Instead, we aim to reinsert female creators and characters into the canon of comics history. This resituation of women in the history of comics requires a deeper look at how women wielded the, however little, power they possessed, and how female characters worked as an outlet for creators to both uphold and overturn hegemonic norms of gender, class, race, and sexuality. Women worked at most of the earliest comic book companies. One of the first was Centaur Publications, which began in 1938, the same year that Superman debuted in Action Comics No. 1. Two of their first creators were Claire S. Moe and June Tarpe Mills, both of whom wrote and drew for Centaur between 1938 and 1940, on such series as Amazing Man Comics, Amazing Mystery Funnies, Funny Pages, Funny Picture Stories, and Keen Detective Funnies. Moe did the story and art for such features as Circus and Sue, Dean Masters, Sunny Darling, and Yellow Terror, while Mills was writer/artist on Barry Finn, Catman, Diane Dean, The Ivy Menace, and The Vampire, the latter two being some of the earliest examples of horror comics, as well as a cover artist. A revisionist history of comics might even start with the origins of the companies that eventually became Marvel and DC Comics, given how these two publishers have come to dominate the male-driven histories of the comics industry. DC's origins stem from the efforts of Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson, who formed National Allied Publications Incorporated in 1934 after more than a decade of writing for pulp magazines. On January 11, 1935, his first comic book, New Fun, hit newsstands. It was the first comic book to feature original stories rather than reprinted material, making it a milestone in the history of the medium. It is also notable for being the first comic book to feature a female character in its lead story. While the series' covers offered stories in panel form, featuring a rotating cast of male characters such as Cowboy Jack Woods and space adventurer Don Drake, the lead story in all 6 issues of New Fun was Sandra of the Secret Service, featuring the serialized adventures of globe-trotting American secret agent Sandra McClain. The cover stories are not included in each issue's table of contents, which always list Sandra's stories on page 1. When the series was rebranded as More Fun with its 7th issue, and then More Fun Comics with number 9, Sandra continued to lead off each issue for more than 2 years, until her final appearance in 1938's More Fun Comics number 34. The character also inspired competing versions in 1937, including Hope Hazard, G-Woman, in 1937's Detective Comics number 3, and G-Woman in New Adventure Comics number 22. All 3 of these series were integral to the early development of DC Comics, which thrived on female heroes well before the debut of Superman in 1938. A forgotten female figure also factors into the history of Timely Comics, which later became Marvel Comics. The company's first effort, 1939's Marvel Comics No. 1, offered readers 2 new heroes who would go on to become mainstays of Marvel Comics throughout later decades, the Human Torch and the Sub-Mariner. Both were created by Funnies, Inc., which was co-owned by Lloyd Jackett, who had been Wheeler Nicholson's lead editor on New Fun. Funnies, Inc. was a packaging shop, which created original material for sale to various comic book publishers, a process known as packaging within the industry. All of the stories and characters featured within the first issue of Marvel Comics originated at the Jacket Shop, including the Angel, the Masked Raider, and Kazar, along with the Sub-Mariner and the Human Torch. But Funnies Inc. was not led by Lloyd Jackett alone. His wife, Grace Jackett, was co-owner of the shop from its inception in 1939 to her death and the company's demise in 1961, and was often closely involved in its production efforts. In an article for the fanzine Alter Ego, Jack Elmy describes his conversation with writer Joe Gill, who did freelance work for Funnies Inc. in the 1940s. Gill recalls Grace Jackett as a wonderful woman who, he says, was an essential part of the shop's day-to-day operations. Timely owner Martin Goodman stopped using the services of Funnies Inc. in 1942, while simultaneously hiring much of Jackett's staff in the process. When Lloyd was deployed as a naval intelligence officer in World War II between 1942 and 1946, Grace became editor-in-chief of Funnies, Inc. With Grace at the helm, the Jacket Shop hired numerous female creators, especially during the war years, including such artists as Nina Albright, Dolores Carroll, Jill Elgin, Lucy Feller, Florence Magarian, June Tarpe Mills, Claire S. Moe, Ramona Patinode, and Janice Volo. Grace's specific role in the production of early Timely Comics material prior to Lloyd's absence remains mostly unknown, but her larger contributions in this era have been overlooked in existing histories of both Funnies Inc. and Timely/Marvel Comics. Timely's creative ranks in the 1940s also included a writer who would soon go on to become a prominent novelist, Patricia Highsmith, whose first novel, Strangers on a Train, was published in 1950 before being adapted as a film by Alfred Hitchcock. Highsmith wrote comics such as Nellie the Nurse for Timely in the late 1940s, while also completing her first novel in this era. Earlier in the decade, she had created the propagandistic hero and unfortunately named Jap Buster Johnston for Timely, along with writing the adventures of characters such as the Black Terror for Better Publications and Spy Smasher for Fawcett Comics, in addition to work for Dell Publications and Novelty Press. In The Talented Miss Highsmith, The Secret Life and Serious Art of Patricia Highsmith, biographer Joan Shankar describes Highsmith's work in comics as an apprenticeship several times, noting how her early comics writing helped her to develop some of the key themes in her later novels, even though she was embarrassed by her early work in the medium. Drawing a direct parallel between Highsmith's comic book work and her characterization of Tom Ripley in her fourth novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley, 1955, Shankar explains, "When Pat gave her criminal hero Tom Ripley a charmed and parentless life, a wealthy, socially posed alter ego, Dickie Greenleaf, and a guilt-free modus operandi, after he kills Dickie, Tom murders only when necessary, she was doing just what her fellow comic book artists were doing with their superheroes, allowing her fictional character to finesse situations she herself could only approach in wish fulfillment. And when she reimagined her own psychological split in Ripley's character, embodying him with both her weakest traits, paralyzing self-consciousness and hero worship, and her wildest dreams, murder and money, she was turning the material of the comic book upside down and making it into something very much like a tragic book." Though the language Shankar uses here fails to appreciate the full value of comics and their place in American popular culture, she is clear in her assertion that American comics held influence over Highsmith long after she left the industry. Shankar writes that while Highsmith's crime novels, such as Strangers on a Train, were influenced by authors like Dostoevsky, Poe, Proust, and James, the themes of her work had also been marinating for 7 long years in the colorful tropes of the American comic book. While Highsmith was loath to discuss her early career in comics, her work for numerous publishers throughout the 1940s made her what Shankar calls the most frequently employed female scriptwriter during the golden age of American comics. Much of the problem in reclaiming the history of non-male creators and characters lies in the historiography that has been used to write existing accounts of the comic industry's evolution. Interviews with male creators who worked in the golden and silver ages of comics have given us valuable first-hand accounts of the day-to-day workings of various publishers, as well as the business decisions and creative choices made in the conception of new titles and characters. But when recalling their non-male counterparts, many interviewees default to describing the physical appearance or emotional temperament of the women they worked with, more than their talents or their work, if these latter aspects were mentioned at all. Recalling Lily Renee, artist Nick Carty says, "She was a good-looking girl, but she stayed pretty much to herself." Of artist Fran Hopper, Carty adds, "She was a nice girl, very quiet and unimposing, and cute." Of artist Jean Levander, he points out that she was big-bosomed, and when she used to stop and give you something at the table, she'd hand the drawing or something over the table, and she'd sit there and she'd sway from side to side with her body. When asked if he recalled timely inker Valerie Barclay, artist Lou Cameron said, "She was very attractive, and she looked like Vampyra. She had white makeup, and the first time I saw her, sizing her up from across the room, I said, 'Gee, I'd like to take that home. But if there are no reflections in the mirrors, she gets a wooden stake between the boobs.'" Cameron also added that Barclay reminded him of Julie Newmar with normal proportions. Similarly, when asked if he remembered artist Anne Brewster, who worked for such publishers as EC Comics, Fawcett, Fiction House, and Timely throughout the 1940s and 1950s, the esteemed writer-slash-artist Joe Simon immediately focused on her body, replying, "Sure, she was quiet, and she was of normal size, normal build, a nice woman." So too does Will Eisner bring in writer Tony Bloom's appearance when recalling her career. "Tony was like a den mother, very attractive, and she worked hard." While men are remembered for their work, what comes to mind about the women who made comics throughout the Golden Age in interviews with their male peers is often not what they created, but what they looked like. The way these women...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?